My castaway this week is a songwriter and a poet. Now 68, she was born in New York to wealthy Jewish parents, but abandoned her bourgeois background to pursue a life of bohemian excess. She mixed with the famous writers of the Beat Generation, such as Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, and Timothy Leary introduced her to LSD. The unknown Woody Allen and Barbara Streisand appeared at the nightclub she ran with her husband. And in the swinging 60s, she came to London and never went home again. Drugs, sex and human miseries make up the raw material of her work, which has been recorded by, among others, Ella Fitzgerald, Shirley Bassey and Bette Midler. Popular on both sides of the Atlantic, her style is highly sardonic. She's written, "I may write a verse that is funny, but mostly laments are my thing, for somehow the song of the honey seems less than the song of the sting." She is Fran Landesman. One thing, however, is true, Fran, you like rhymes.
I do like rhymes.
It always rhymes, does it?
It's funny because when I first came to England, I began, Michael Horowitz invited me to read with the poets. I was the only poet who rhymed at all. I mean, the modern poets just turn their back on rhyme.
They can be quite snobbish about people who rhyme.
Indeed. Mere verse. As a matter of fact, I never call myself a poet, and I am very honored when somebody else uses that word, but I think of myself as a songwriter.
But give me a couplet that you're really proud of. I mean, a rhyme. That's difficult to put you on the spot.
Oh, here's one. His assets have been overtaxed. He's trying hard to look relaxed. His latest dream has just been axed. He's oversexed and underfaxed.
It's good, isn't it? You did, of course, write Life's a Bitch. I mean, that's your line.
No, it was Cosmo's. My son Cosmo, he walked into my room one time, and I remember him saying, "Life is a bitch," and I'd sat down and wrote that lyric.
But Life's a Bitch was a great favorite of Bette Davis, wasn't it?
I was so honored, because of all the movie stars, she was my favorite. And when she came here, she made a record, and she recorded All the Sad Young Men, which it didn't turn out well, and they didn't include it in the final thing. But she called me up, and she invited me to tea and all of that.
But one of the best-known lines, I think, is one that one would never have thought, best-known lines that you've written, would never have thought would have caught on, which is "Spring can really hang you up the most," which is sort of great, syntactically quite dubious, I think. Where did that come from?
Well, I had just started hanging out with jazz musicians and listening to the way they spoke. And I realized one day, I was thinking about April is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire, those lines of Eliot's. And I thought the way the jazz musicians would say that would be, "Spring can really hang you up the most." And I told this piano player about it. I said, "Wouldn't it make a funny song title?" And he said, "Yes, why don't you write it?"
And now it's a kind of standard jazz classic.
Yes, but because of the music that he put to it.
But your poetry in the main, as I was trying to say in the introduction, is born of your experiences, isn't it? It's what you've been through, but with a dollop of humour, or that wryness, that sort of sardonic wit thrown in. One of your latest, and I wondered if you'd read it to us, actually, before we hear your first record, one which I think has a theme which may be quite close to your heart now, because it's about ageing.
Oh, yes. "Goodbye days of jazz and joking. Goodbye booze and food that's fried. Goodbye glamour, so long smoking. Hello, thoughts of suicide. Farewell days of fun and flirting. So long, sex, so glad we came. Now there's always something hurting. Hello, specs and walking frame. So long, lovely finger lickers. Goodbye, life that late we led. Hello, cramps and dodgy tickers. Soon we'll be the grateful dead. Goodbye, Ronnie. Goodbye, Lenny. Goodbye, pretty girls and boys. Got to go and spend a penny. Hello, geriatric joys."
So to music, tell me about your first record.
My first record is a song that I used to sing to my children when they were little. It's called "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime" from the Depression. And the boys used to say, "Mommy, sing Dime Song." And then they'd try to press a coin into my hands while I did this affecting number.
Once I built a tower to the sun, built of brick and mortar and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Judy Collins singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime from the musical Americana. Now, you, Fran Landesman, as I said, in the 1950s, ran a nightclub in St. Louis or St. Louis called the Crystal Palace with your husband, Jay. Barbara Streisand sang there. She was unknown. Did you know even then that she was something special?
Yes, we did. She was simply marvelous. She was a wonderful singer, but she wanted to be a comedienne. And she used to do all kinds of funny little routines, and she would change the show every night. And somebody said to her, why don't you do that show you did on opening night? That was so good. And she said, I get bored doing the same songs every night. And Jay said to her, you punk, you've been in show business for 2 weeks and you're bored already.
And Woody Allen was around too. What was he like?
Woody Allen, terrified. Every single night, I couldn't believe it. He would pace up and down his dressing room and I'd sort of hang out with him. He'd say, I hope they're going to be nice tonight. I do hope they're going to be nice tonight.
And constantly on the phone to his analyst, apparently.
On the phone to the analyst. And the phone was sort of outside of the toilet, so there'd be sort of like a queue of people waiting for the loo.
Or listening to
him on his conversation.
And who, I mean, what other, this is a good name-dropping session, really. Lenny Bruce was around, wasn't
he?
History has it that he wanted you to run away with him, is that right?
He did say something like that. Come on the road with me. We'll send your old man a little money every month, he said.
But he did something worse than that. I mean, you didn't go with him, but he did something. He injected you in the behind with heroin, is that right?
Not heroin, Dilaudid, which is a synthetic form of heroin that he was using. And I upchucked for about 9 hours. It cured me of any
But why did he do it?
Ever again. He said, you want to try this? I said, no, it's going to make me throw up. He said, nah, it won't. And I was wearing a knitted skirt, and he just did it right through the skirt. And then it did make me throw up.
But you were pretty into drugs in that period, in your,
well,
been in your 20s.
Well, smoked grass, but that's really different from, I mean, I was never into heavy downers, for sure.
But what about Timothy Leary and the LSD?
Yes.
Do you remember that first?
Yes. I remember it as being, to quote Shakespeare, he said this of love, it lends a precious seeing to the eye. I don't want to sound like I'm proselytizing for LSD, but it does make you see the world, the sea, the beach, the sky, all of that. Incredibly enhanced. And afterwards, you only have to do it once or twice. You can remember how you see that forever, really.
You don't want to go and see it again.
Well, no, it's too strenuous. Not at my age.
But did it make a difference? I mean, to how much difference did it make, I think, is the question, to all of those people, that scene you were in. How much difference did the drugs make? Do you think that you wrote things or poetry was written, things were created that wouldn't otherwise have been created?
For me, it was a college education.
Tell me about your second record.
It's from the Threepenny Opera, and it's Mack the Knife. And the reason, in German, the reason I've chosen it is that when I met J. Irving Landesman, and he took me to his flat with one Eames chair and a Jackson Pollock spattered floor, he had one record, and it was the Threepenny Opera. It was in German, and I'd never heard this song before, and it sounded wonderfully kind of sexy and decadent and all that. I had no idea what it was about till years later when I heard a translation of it.
Und das große Feuer in Soho, sieben Kinder und ein Greis in der Menge Mäckimesser, den man nicht fragt und der nichts weiß.
Lotte Lenya singing Die Moritat von Mäckimesser, the ballad of Mack the Knife, written by Kurt Weill. Your husband, Fran Landesman, Jay Landesman, has written that when you two met in 1950, you were, and I quote, a classy uptown broad in full rebellion. So what were you rebelling against? Who and what were you? Are you?
What is Marlon Brando said when they asked him that question, what do you got? My mother tells me that the first word she ever remembers me uttering when I was a tiny little child was, Mommy, when am I going to get my freedom? I didn't want any kind of restraints.
But you were very well off, weren't you? The family was very well healed.
Yes. We lived on Central Park West.
Rather loveless in your home?
We didn't see a great deal of our parents, really.
And your mother didn't like you very much?
Oh, she gave me a lot. You know, I had this constant fight with her, but she took me to the theater. She read aloud beautifully. She read plays and poetry, and she could sing. She was very musical. She discouraged me from singing, though. She said I had a voice like a cow. She was critical, let's put it that way.
She said you were fat. You were fat.
Yes,
point,
I was.
Weren't you? How fat?
Well, she used to describe me as a monstrosity. She used to say, it brings tears to my eyes when I see that poor swollen body of yours. You monster.
When did you
say you want to commit suicide? I'll open the window for you. You can jump. Really? They were tough. My parents were tough.
When did you stop being fat?
I was beginning to stop before I met Jay, but my ambition was to weigh less than Jay because he was extremely skinny. And somehow after I met him, I just started getting thinner and thinner. I guess it was just hanging out with thin people makes you thin.
And you were in love, perhaps. But it was Jay who changed your life, really. Meeting him, the whole thing kind of began to gel, didn't it?
Absolutely.
You were where it was at, and that was where you'd been trying to get to.
Yep.
Bohemian life.
He was the editor of Neurotica magazine.
Which was what?
Well, he published Allen Ginsberg's Pull My Daisy. It was the first underground magazine, and it criticized American culture. It sort of almost satirized it all.
So you entered his life, you entered his circle of friends, and you were home. Is that how it felt?
Yes, yes, yes.
Tell me about number three.
The Ballad of the Sad Young Men, sung by Roberta Flack. It's the title of a collection of short stories by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Most people don't know that, or they will accuse me of stealing it, and I say I assume that anyone who's literate knows that.
All the sad young men choking on their youth, trying to be brave, running from the truth.
The Ballad of the Sad Young Men, sung by Roberta Flack, and those lyrics by Fran Landesman, my castaway, about the young men who hung out in New York bars in the 50s and refused to grow up. It's also, though, the title of your first book of poems. Do you write them differently when they're supposed to be poems on a page, or are they intrinsically the same?
I always say the only way you can tell the poems from the songs is that the poems don't rhyme.
But they do.
No, I have a lot of poems that don't. I'm really proud. When I want to be a serious... Here's a shorty. I call this a Jewish haiku. That summer I met a handsome biker on crutches. Everybody's got a brick wall waiting for them somewhere, he said, smiling.
Try and set that to music. But can any poem be set to music? Can you just play some jazz in the background and read it out? I mean, is that how
yes.
it happens?
I mean, there was a whole movement of people reading poetry to jazz.
And indeed, it's quite fashionable again now. I mean, you've got
they
the lead singer of Blur now quoting his poetry on the stage.
He did it at the Poetry Olympics at Albert Hall.
Now, you also published a poem way back, which seems to me to sum up the way that you and Jay have led your married life. It's called Semi-Detached. I wonder if you'd read it to me.
Yes, I remember. I wrote this on the way back from Liverpool on a train, and we were passing all these semi-detached houses, and I could hear the train going, semi-detached, 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 and I wrote this. My sweetie and I are semi-detached. We're comfy and cool and perfectly matched. His lover is Anne, my lover is Art. We're semi-detached but never apart. When some of our loves are semi-destroyed, we make it all right by quoting them Freud. We play little games and never get scratched. It's easy because we're semi-detached. We each have a side that's free as the air, and people don't see the side that we share. Our setup is sweet. There isn't a catch. The secret is living semi-detached.
That's, of course, what you and Jay became very famous for in the 60s. You were said to be the pioneers of an open marriage, weren't you, of having other sexual partners than each other.
I'm sure we weren't the pioneers. I think we went back to Bloomsbury and further than that.
And further back, probably. But, I mean, tell me about it. Is it as easy as it sounds? Surely not. Surely there's a lot of pain in it.
Yes, but I think there's a lot of pain in almost any enterprise. There's no such thing as unalloyed joy. That's all I can say.
But don't you put yourself in the path of even greater pain if you openly take a lover, you know, in front of your husband? He openly takes one in front of you, surely, you know.
Well,
I don't know, I'm being very conventional here, but, I mean, tell me what the argument is, because it seems to me that love and marriage is about fidelity.
I think the idea of limiting yourself for all of your life to one person, they can't do everything. Suppose Jay likes to play tennis or listen to different music, and all those people, it isn't all about sex, which is what people think it is. It's about all the things that other people can bring into your life. I think part of it is you have to have the security to believe that the person that you're with really loves you first and puts you first, and you're not going to lose them. And if you know that, then it doesn't worry you if they spend an afternoon in somebody else's company, and it shouldn't worry them.
And did you go on feeling like that even when you had children? Because you then had two little boys, didn't you? And that open marriage is still going on.
It's certainly harder for a woman to carry on like this, just because I was always there for my children. I mean, I didn't want them to wake up in the morning and say, "Where's mommy?" I had to be there, and I was always there to put a meal on the table. It's hard to remember accurately, and I want to be as truthful as I can. There must have been moments when it was really painful, but I think for me, it was worth conquering those feelings, because what I gained from a more open lifestyle and a wider list of acquaintances, shall we say, or friends, I feel compensated for the pain of the momentary jealousy. And it always went away again, because we're still together. A lot of people...
I was going to say, the proof is in the pudding, really. Your marriage has lasted,
hasn't it? Telling me how pretty I am at the age of almost 70. So what more could one ask?
You've been married 46 years. Are you still in love, then?
Yes, I think we are. More than ever, as a matter of fact.
Do you still have affairs?
No. Definitely not.
Neither of you.
I felt that... Well, maybe he does a bit, but men can get away with that. I remember when... Joan Collins and all those women were in their 50s talking about toy boys, etc. And they were still beautiful, desirable women, and it made perfect sense. But there is a cutoff, and I think the big 6-0 is where I would personally cut it off. But everybody can make their own decisions about those things. After that, I became Granny Franny.
Record number 4.
Oh, Miles Davis and Sketches of Spain. Well, we did know Miles. He lived across the river in East St. Louis. And we used to listen to this record by the swimming pool. We had the speakers outside, and I just remember that wonderful horn of his drifting over the pool as I lay there in the sun.
Miles Davis playing part of his Sketches of Spain, arranged and conducted by Gil Evans. So, Fran, the two of you, well, four of you, actually, because you had two small boys by this time, came to London in 1964, height of the swinging 60s. You apparently came for what someone called a talent tune-up, but you never went back. Why? What happened? What
we only expected to stay for a year. I always say I became addicted to the BBC, Radio 4.
No, can't have been just that.
No, it was just wonderful. Although at first I couldn't understand any of the jokes. I kept trying to read Private Eye. I couldn't understand what was funny. But by the end of a year, I began to be clued into all the references.
But who did you meet? Who took you in? What became your circle here?
It was... Just before we came to America, we ran into Peter Cook in a bar, and he said, "Call me when you get to London." And we called him, and he invited us to dinner. And I wrote some songs with Dudley Moore. And I met Ned Charon, who was producing a television program called Not So Much a Program, More a Way of Life.
So you found your niche,
yeah.
Really. You wrote lyrics for,
instantly.
For that. Yeah. And you wrote a poem, of course, Yankee Doodle London. Just give me a bit of it, because it's...
Oh, it's about the, because it is a different language. My washcloth is my flannel, my apartment is my flat. I saunter down to Soho and have dinner at the Trat. I know the drill, I've sussed the scene. It's biscuit now, not cookie. I've got a turf accountant where I used to have a bookie. But I just can't say can't. I just can't say can't. I'll do most anything you want, but I just can't say can't.
But you can say can't, no. Just, with difficulty.
Just barely.
Record number 5. Tell me about that.
This is a song by that cute Jarvis Cocker. I saw him on the television when he just had a go at Michael Jackson. But then I heard this song of his. I have a friend named Howard Samuels, and he was performing in cabaret. And afterwards I went up and I said, "Where did you find that wonderful song, The Common People?" He said, "Oh, that's by Jarvis Cocker." So I wanted to have something contemporary. I like to hear new songs, songs that I've never heard before. And I'm not that familiar with Pulp, but on this desert island, maybe if I took this record, I would get to know his work better.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room with Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people.
Pulp and Common People, and that's from their album Different Glass. You have two boys, Fran, as we've mentioned, Cosmo and Miles. Miles Davis, of course. What sort of parents do you think you and Jay made?
Well, both of my boys are healthy, they haven't been in jail, they're not drug addicts. And Cosmo did that relative values thing with me in the Times, and he said in print that I wasn't all that bad of a mom, although I embarrassed them. Everybody's parents embarrassed.
But he said, I think he said he was very embarrassed to see you at the school gates. I mean, what would you and Jay have looked like at the school gates in what would have been the 60s, late 60s, I suspect?
Richard Neville, who edited Oz, had one of those Afghan coats, and he dyed his blue. So I decided to dye mine purple in the bathtub. And I guess I didn't realize that it looked so weird. I did wear that to Cosmo's school once, and he's never let me forget it.
And you used to tell him, I think, to hang loose and lighten up. You sound like the sort of parents every teenager thinks they want, really.
I know. That's what Cosmo says. All his friends said that I'd love to have parents like that, but of course Cosmo wanted something a little bit more traditional. As a matter of fact, he moved in with some English friends of ours, the Brookses, for a year just to sort of get
away from you.
Get away from the craziness, yes.
And what about Miles?
No, it's always the oldest child that has these problems with his parents. Miles is my younger child, and he doesn't have any problems with us at all. As a matter of fact, Miles and I perform. He's a songwriter and guitar player, and we do a lot of gigs together.
But you make Cosmo sound rather like that girl in Absolutely Fabulous who sort of disapproves of her mother, Jennifer Saunders, you know.
Exactly like that. But I'm so proud of him, and I think he's very clever and funny and charming with it. I don't want him to sound like a total pain in the ass.
But would you recommend it as a way of parenting, or looking back on it, do you think perhaps it was just...
Oh, I think it's ideal loose? Because if you're terribly strict and unpermissive, your children can turn into dope fiends. And if you're loose and permissive like us, they can turn into dope fiends. It doesn't seem to matter how you do it. I think it's really important for children to know that they're loved and that you care about them and that they're important.
But you say you're now Granny Franny. I mean, I suppose that's the great test, isn't it? Do you worry when you see your grandchildren now being brought up? You know, would it worry you to think of those children being brought up as you brought up your children?
It's impossible to... My children, you didn't have to lock the door. They were in and out of the house. They'd go off with their friends to football matches with their rosettes and all that. And now everything is so much more dangerous. Jay and I went around telling people to loosen up. I think it's time that people stopped loosening up.
Tell me about the next piece of music, number 6.
This is a song I used to sing to my children. Somebody said I used to sing very depressing songs to them, but they used to say, sing that song about the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. It's Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit. You're a perfect singer, you say, Fran.
Yes, yes. I have a lot of songs that I wish you were around to sing.
Now, we cast you away, as you know, on a desert island on this programme. Do you think you'd survive for long? Do you think much about death?
Yes, I do think about death and write about it a lot. But the thought of dying alone on a desert island, I must admit, gives me the shivers.
But you've lived quite dangerously, haven't you? Jay says you're fascinated. Again, let me quote your husband to you. He says you're fascinated by death. You've threatened to jump out of windows. You've crossed streets carelessly.
Yes, yes.
Do you think you'd resort to suicide if you were condemned to a solitary existence.
Possibly. I can't imagine being alone on a desert island, really, even though that's the object of this exercise.
Could you look after yourself?
Not really. I couldn't make a shelter. I couldn't escape. I'm not a country... I have a thing about it. I'm not a nature poet. I sing a city song. I wouldn't be really good on a desert island.
More music.
We've come to me. Shall I explain about this? I began, really... to be a poet because I met Michael Horowitz, and he invited me to perform with a troupe of performing poets. And we did something called the Poetry Olympics, and this is a cut from that LP with my son Miles, who I do a lot of gigging with, playing guitar for me. And it's his setting of a poem of mine called White Nightmare. Also, it attacks the question of racism, so I'm quite proud of it in that sense, because it's not so easy to write about racism without sounding like some bit of agitprop, sort of. So there you go.
White playground for a white race. No shadows in this white place. No hiding from the white glare. White nightmare. White nightmare.
My castaway Fran Landesman performing her poem White Nightmare, which was recorded in 1982 at the Poetry Olympics. So bed now plays a very central role in your life, Fran, not for sex, because you've given that up, but for everything else, I understand. What percentage of your life do you spend in and on your bed?
On bed, not in bed, but on bed. I practically do everything on that bed. It's my raft in a sea of dreams.
And your husband has his own bed downstairs in the basement. So what part of your lives do you spend together?
Oh, every first thing, I wake up in the morning terribly depressed. I don't know, the news or whatever it is, and I feel really sour. And then I come downstairs and I meet Jay. Something about him, he cheers me up instantly. And we take a walk to Al's Cafe in Exmouth Market, the best cappuccino west of Rome. It's excellent. And the walk is through this little park, which we call Angel Park. And there's a statue to the airman who died in the last war of a giant angel, and she always has all these pigeons on her wings.
So this is the recipe for a happy marriage, is it?
I think if you've got somebody living on top of you in your room and you worry about their mess and your mess, especially if you're and you were etc., ultimately I think that separate rooms is the secret of a happy marriage, but I recognize it's a great luxury. I mean, most people don't have that much space and can't afford to do it, but if you can. Because then you're always glad to see the person. They're not just somebody that's there. They're a welcomed and honored and treasured guest.
Tell me about your last record.
My last record is the fruit of my collaboration with Simon Wallace. And it's sung by a wonderful girl, Nikki Layton Thomas. And the three of us, she says she's waited all her life to find these songs of mine. She really knows the way to get to a girl. Anyway, we have a whole bunch of shows and things, and this is... They also did this at the Royal Shakespeare Company, did a little show recently. And one of the boys from Trainspotting was in it. I was so proud. And they called the show Down.
Down has some terrible attractions, featuring some desperate distractions. And that hooker misery sings, I'll never set you free, 'cause there's something irresistible in Down. Down makes some dangerous suggestions, taunts you with those sweet, depressing questions.
Down, written by Fran Landesman and Simon Wallace, and sung by Nikki Layton Thomas. If you could only take one of those records, Fran, which one?
I think that would be it. Certainly today it's the one I would take.
But tomorrow it might be.
Tomorrow it might be another one, yes.
What about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got Shakespeare, as you know.
I think I would... Jay's written two volumes of memoirs. One's called Rebel Without a Clause and the other's called Jaywalking. I'd like to have them both bound together in one book. It's
Walk back through your life.
Yes.
And what about your luxury?
Cannabis seeds.
Not a bed.
Well, I was wondering...
You're going to manage without that bed?
Be very hard. But actually, if I could grow myself some grass, I would probably not... miss the bed as much as I'd miss the smoke.
Okay. Fran Landesman, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.